The Fiesta Bowl this week continued its efforts to move past a recent scandal with the naming of a new executive director. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, the Arizona Republic's Craig Harris will tell us who Mike Neely is and in what direction he's supposed to lead the Valley-based bowl game. Plus, the book This Town chronicles the powerful politicians and pundits of Washington, D.C., and how their personal ambitions affect how business gets done. I'll talk with the author, Mark Leibovich, and find out from longtime Arizona political watchers Stan Barnes and Chip Scutari just how similar our state capital is to the nation's capital. Also, the Food and Drug Administration has proposed regulations on electronic cigarettes, including efforts to prevent kids from using them. Craig Weiss, CEO of Scottsdale-based Enjoy, will discuss his business and what he thinks of the FDA's announcement. And Michael Abramowitz of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is in town to talk about the dangers of hate speech. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, how much does our state capital have in common with the nation's capital when it comes to political deal-making, egos, and intrigue? I'll talk with author Mark Leibovich. His book, This Town, chronicles the politically powerful in D.C. Then we'll get insights on our own local elected officials from Stan Barnes and Chip Scutari. Plus, the Food and Drug Administration has issued proposed regulations for the electronic cigarette industry. Craig Weiss of Scottsdale-based e-cigarette maker Enjoy will tell us what he thinks about the government action. Also, how powerful is hate speech? Michael Abramowitz of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is in town to address that, and he'll talk to us as well. We start today's program with the news from earlier this week that the Fiesta Bowl had found its full-time successor to former executive director Robert Shelton, who resigned in January. The Fiesta Bowl is just one of the things reporter Craig Harris covers for the Arizona Republic, and he joins me now. Craig, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, good to have you. So who is new executive director Mike Neely? What do we need to know about his background and what he brings to the table?
Well, he was with the Coyotes. He was their president and chief operating officer, and he has quite a background in the National Hockey League. And he was, you know, pretty successful with the Coyotes during a time when, you know, they didn't have an owner. And so he comes in to the Fiesta Bowl with a pretty good background here and knows the Valley pretty well and seems like a really good guy.
What does this tell you about the direction the Fiesta Bowl is going? And are there similarities, differences you can tell us between what we expect from Neely and what they were getting from Robert Shelton?
Well, there's a huge difference now because what Shelton did is he kind of came in during a time when there was a huge scandal during the John Junker era where, you know, he was ousted for lavish spending and subsequently convicted for a campaign finance scheme. And he's actually going to be going to prison next month. So, you know, Dr. Shelton came in from the University of Arizona, kind of stabilized things, got the bowl into the new college football playoff, which was going to be for the next 12 years. And the bowl decided they wanted to go in yet another direction, and they parted ways with Dr. Shelton back earlier this year, and now have hired Mike Neely.
Craig, I know we don't know much about Mike yet, I guess, even though he has been with the Coyotes, as you mentioned, but does he seem like someone who's more comfortable in those sort of glad-handing situations than Robert Shelton was?
You know, I don't know Mike all that well either. You know, as far as being a CEO of a local team, he wasn't as outspoken or as more of a face of a franchise as say, like a Derek Hall is with the Diamondbacks, where almost everyone in town knows Derek and all the activities he's been in. But I think by talking to Mike, he does have a pretty good grasp of what needs to happen at the Bowl. And one of the biggest things they have to do is they've just got to sell more tickets. One of the biggest changes under this new system in college football, from the old Bowl Championship Series to this new college football playoff, is teams playing in the Fiesta Bowl will be required to buy about 5,000 tickets less than before. So instead of having a guarantee that each team would buy 17,500 tickets, each team only has to buy 12,500. So that means the Fiesta Bowl's got to sell 10,000 more tickets. That's a lot, especially when tickets are, you know, $150 to $300 a ticket. I mean, that's a big thing he's going to have to go out and sell to this community.
And how hard is that going to be when the Fiesta Bowl in the years when it's not hosting the actual championship game? Because people don't really know what this playoff system is quite yet, right?
Well, yeah, but I think under this new system, they will actually get better matchups than in some years when you've had Connecticut here, which has been kind of a bust. The theory or hope with this new college playoff system is that you're going to get better games for these six elite bowls, which include the Fiesta Bowl. So you may not have an automatic tie-in with the Big 12, which they had for a lot of years, but you're probably going to get two really good kind of West Coast or Western Mountain West teams playing here that should draw a lot of fans. And so theoretically, you should be able to sell those tickets a little bit easier than in the past when you had, you know, a team from the East that had no drawing power here at all.
And Craig, you mentioned the ticket sales, so I wonder, what does this mean overall as far as the playoff system is concerned as well about the actual money the Fiesta Bowl can clear? Is this going to be a concern for the Bowl or no?
Well, it is a huge concern for the Bowl because in the past, when the Fiesta Bowl hosted the national championship game, that was just a huge financial bonanza for the Bowl, where all the money that came in was kept by the Bowl under the new system, the college football playoff, which is run by the essentially the big five power conferences. They keep all the money, and they realize that their game is so big now that communities are bidding on that game. So now, instead of keeping all the money, the Fiesta Bowl has to spend money to get that championship game when it's going to come here in January of 2016. So, you know, the Fiesta Bowl has, like a lot of other big bowls, is under a whole new different financial game. And, you know, the Fiesta Bowl also has done some pretty significant layoffs this year as they've kind of shrunk their staff in preparing for this kind of new era for college football.
That's where I wanted to close with you, Craig. Follow up a little bit more on that, because when we hear about a new executive director, there's the feeling the game is on more solid ground than it had been. And yet when you hear about layoffs, in what departments were those folks laid off?
Well, they laid off from their – they weren't clear exactly, but from what I understand, they've released from their public relations side, a few other folks who have been there for quite a while. I mean, they just tried to shrink their staff to put their staff in more in line of the staff that's at the Rose Bowl or the Sugar Bowl. The difference is the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl don't also handle a sister game, the Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl. So, you know, there was a time that the Fiesta Bowl was considered pretty heaviest for their staff, and they traditionally had paid their executives some of the highest salaries in college football for bowl games. So that has changed. They've reined in kind of their upper echelon salaries. Part of that, too, is they've got to finish paying off Dr. Shelton for, I think, the year and a half, 2 years he had left his contract. Yeah. So, you know, they've got some expenses they have to pay out as they're kind of going to this new model. Now, they're not broke. I mean, their most recent tax returns showed they had $26 million in net assets. But for the fiscal year that ended in 2012-13, they lost $1.3 million. So no business can keep incurring financial losses despite how much you have in the bank.
Craig Harris of the Arizona Republic. Craig, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Thank you so much.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Even with health warnings and often scary ads about the dangers, maybe you or some of your friends still smoke cigarettes, or you're in a transition stage, experimenting with electronic cigarettes. Last week, the Food and Drug Administration proposed regulations for e-cigarettes, including blocking sales to minors and forcing manufacturers to include health warnings on the devices. Craig Weiss is CEO of Scottsdale-based Enjoy, one of the largest e-cig makers, and he joins me now. Craig, how big is Enjoy's market share at this point?
Depending on what syndicated data source you use, Enjoy's market share is approximately 16% of the retail market in the United States. And that information is, you know, for C-stores, C-stores being convenience stores, which is where about 75% of all of the tobacco products are sold in the United States today. We're also sold in Walmart, in Walgreens, in Sam's Club, and in Costco, which isn't captured in that C-store data set that I just provided. So I would say we're one of the top three electronic cigarette brands at retail in the United States.
The FDA recently proposed regulations on e-cigarettes. Are you supportive, or do you think your business will be handcuffed?
Well, we're very pleased with the FDA's position on their proposed regulations that they had announced last week. And we very much believe that the category needs reasonable regulation. And we've long advocated, both publicly and in our private meetings with the FDA, we've communicated to them our desire for there to be a reasonable regulation for the category to provide consumer confidence that people know what they're getting when they buy these products. They know what's in them. They know they're being manufactured up to a certain standard that's acceptable. And so we were very pleased with the FDA's proposed regulations. We think, also importantly, it's a very clear message to cities and states that have more recently been trying to weigh in on electronic cigarettes, you know, in the absence of FDA action. It's a clear call, okay, the FDA is on the job, and they are making their decisions based on science and data, and they've solicited public comment for electronic cigarettes so that they can have the data necessary to make informed policy decisions. And now that the world's premier science-based regulatory agency is on the job, I think it's an important message to cities and states that to let the FDA do their job here.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with the president and CEO of Enjoy, e-cigarette maker here in the Valley, Craig Weiss. Craig, to what extent do children need to be protected from your product in the same way regulations try to keep them from using traditional cigarettes?
Our children absolutely need to be protected from electronic cigarettes, and responsible companies like Enjoy take every possible precaution to make sure that our products don't fall into the hands of minors. So for example, not only does Enjoy support the FDA's proposed ban on the sale of electronic cigarettes to people under legal smoking age, we years ago had been a proponent of that and have supported every state effort to do that. In addition, Enjoy's a member of the National WeCard Age Verification Program, which educates retailers to make sure that they are informed so as to not allow minors to purchase products. And then on top of that, we sell our products in non-self-service displays so that there's a clerk required transaction to purchase the product. And we don't sell candy flavors like gummy bear or bubble gum or things that might appeal to children. So I think those are the types of steps that need to be taken. And I think the concern about children is a valid one. And it also needs to be seen, though, in the broader context, which is that according to the Surgeon General, there are 6 million children living today in the United States that will one day die prematurely from tobacco use if present trends continue. And it's our job at Enjoy to disrupt those present trends and to allow our children to grow up in a world that's free of tobacco.
Craig, is this a product, and are there scientists both within Enjoy and outside of Enjoy that prove that this is a product that is less risky to people's health than traditional cigarettes?
With respect to health, it's important that members of public health weigh in on this, and certainly we're not permitted to discuss health in a consumer-marketed message. The Surgeon General's report that came out just a few months ago made clear that the primary source of harm associated with tobacco cigarettes is their combustion. And electronic cigarettes provide a non-combustible delivery of nicotine. I think that's an important thing to understand. And we want to lead the area of science with respect to scientific testing, which we've done, and we've published those results in peer-reviewed scientific journal articles, and want to continue to lead the charge with respect to a better understanding of the science of these products.
Craig, finally, is there a perception that your product is dangerous? Are you fighting an uphill battle to gain the public's trust that your product really is a good alternative to tobacco and traditional cigarettes?
In some ways, I think there is a bit of an uphill battle for a couple of reasons. One is I certainly didn't choose the name electronic cigarette, and it's got that word cigarette in it, which is very hard to unring that bell. It's hard to think of a word that has a closer association with death and disease than cigarettes. And so there's a perception issue that electronic cigarettes face, when in fact there's no burning, there's no combustion, there's no tobacco in our product, and that we are, in essence, an electronic nicotine delivery system. And I think the other issue that I think is a perception that we deal with that's problematic is you have a health epidemic in the United States, this tobacco epidemic, that claims the lives of prematurely of over 450,000 Americans every year. It's almost a silent slaughter of our citizens that is greeted with mostly apathy. So there's a sort of a view that, well, this is a self-inflicted harm, and so people know the risks, and if they want to smoke, then that's their business. And so I think there's that same general apathy is applied to what we believe is the solution as opposed to the problem. I think if we take a step back and say one of the greatest possible impacts that we can have on our society and our economy is ending this tobacco epidemic. It's literally costing our country over $200 billion a year in direct and indirect costs, healthcare costs, lost productivity, and the ability to have a technology that could potentially solve that problem. It's an incredible opportunity, and hopefully people see it for that and embrace it.
Craig Weiss is president and CEO of Scottsdale-based Enjoy, the e-cigarette maker. Last week, the FDA announced plans to regulate e-cigarettes. To come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Mark Leibovich, author of This Town. He's speaking tonight at ASU's Cronkite School about the inner workings and behind-the-scenes politics of D.C. Then we'll talk with our own local experts, Stan Barnes and Chip Scutari, about the comparison and contrast between our state capital and the nation's capital. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Child's Play. The musical cartoon series Schoolhouse Rock comes to life on stage. Families can sing along to Schoolhouse Rock live at Tempe Center for the Arts through May 25th. Childsplayaz.org.
You're listening to Here and Now on 91.5 FM KJZZ. Checking temperatures around the state right now, Flagstaff reporting partly sunny skies and 46 degrees. It's cloudy and 53 in Prescott, sunny and 68 in Casa Grande. Tucson reporting mostly sunny skies and 68 degrees as well. It's mostly sunny and 73 right now in Yuma. In Valley traffic on the southbound Loop 101 Price Freeway, there is a crash on the shoulder at Ray Road. You can experience more great music with Jazz in Phoenix. Give a listen to this service at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Mostly sunny skies and 68 degrees in Phoenix at 1122.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. You've heard the candidates running for Congress who say they'll go back to the nation's capital and change Washington. If elected, they'll serve their time and then come home where they belong. In his book, This Town, though, Mark Leibovich of the New York Times Magazine says Washington has become a revolving door for politicians who become lobbyists and a place that makes a lot of them rich. Leibovich will be speaking tonight at ASU's Walter Cronkite School, and he's with me now. So based on the reporting and the stories you tell, do you laugh every time you hear someone say he or she is going to change Washington?
I don't know if I laugh. It does seem to keep happening. And look, I think it's good that people continue to believe that they can come in and actually make a difference. And I say that not trying to be patronizing in any way or even defeatist in any way. But look, I mean, our country was built on people believing and hopefully executing on influencing their government and hopefully moving it forward in a direction that history will judge, noble. And so I do think that one of the great signs of hope coming out of this book and even coming out of this era is that people continue to be involved, they continue to believe, and politics is as passionate a sport, I guess, or a reality or a way of life for more people now than it seems to have been in a long time. So I think that that's all positive. And look, our politics is very, very dysfunctional for a lot of obvious reasons. But I think that again, the ongoing struggle and challenge to try to make the world better and to make our government better, I think, is real. And it's one that I was heartened to see going forward.
People like to cast blame on things, and there are times that, we're not getting the best people running for office because of the system or because of this or that. Do you think we are electing good people and that the system is messed up, or are we emphasizing the negative too much?
First of all, I mean, everyone's different. I think there's obviously good and bad, and I think that there are a lot of people who come to Washington for the right reasons, and a lot of people stay in Washington for probably not the right reasons. I mean, I think one thing that the system, I think, has created, especially in Washington, is one of self-perpetuation, where people really try, for a lot of reasons, and really at any price, to sort of propel their career forward, whether in office or to try to become wealthy when they leave office. And if you sort of look at how people view public service now in Washington, I mean, 50% of all U.S. senators go on to become lobbyists. That compares to 3% in 1974. In some ways, the city that was supposedly built on public service has been given over to self-service. And Washington has become the wealthiest metropolitan area in the United States, and that wasn't true 30 years ago. And it also, it was not really the ethic that brought people to the city. So I think that there's plenty of blame to go around. I think the system is corroded, and I think that the whole machine that's grown up, which I tried to deconstruct in this town, has gotten pretty rotten.
When we hear people talk about what's going on outside the Beltway, are people so, I'll use the term protected, but are they just so entrenched in what's going on in Washington, they really don't know what's going on outside the Beltway, or is that something that pundits like to say?
Right. I think that's a great question. I mean, I think one of the reasons I wrote This Town is because I wanted to give people a fuller cinemagraphic sort of sense of the kinds of personalities, the kind of antics, the kind of parties, the kind of Mardi Gras that goes on there on the day-to-day basis. I mean, ultimately, This Town is about disconnect. It's about disconnect between the level of self-celebration that goes on in Washington, D.C. versus the level of revulsion that so many people out in the country have for the politics of the city. It's also about the disconnect between the wealth that's gone on there, that's grown up in Washington, D.C. versus the very, very real economic struggles that have gone on in the rest of the country for the last 6-7 years. So, again, I think people look on TV, they see a city that is hopelessly divided. I, living there, actually see one that is hopelessly interconnected. And you have this sort of system in which it's not so much you have Democrats and Republicans in Washington as you have millionaires and you have people who are on the inside and who can profit from that. So that's sort of the new game now. And I wanted to give people outside of D.C. a fuller understanding of what that looks like.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Mark Leibovich, author of This Town, which is just out in paperback. Mark will be at ASU's Cronkite School having a conversation Wednesday night. Is it more difficult to be a journalist with some influence? You also write about NBC's Andrea Mitchell, Mary to Alan Greenspan, some of the pressure she got from her bosses not to cover certain issues that might overlap with what he did. Is it odd that it sounds like a place where you have the elected officials who are powerful, but you also have media people who are incredibly influential? Are they able to separate there?
Not always at all. I mean, it's a very small and interconnected town. And the reason I wanted to start the book at Tim Russert's funeral was that you had this epic scene where you have this beloved newsman who, you know, died in the prime of his life right at the dawn of the general election in 2008. And I was in the Kennedy Center. I mean, I didn't know Tim well, but I knew him a little bit, you know, and I was just sitting there, and I was struck by how this very solemn tribal occasion almost became, first of all, almost a cocktail party. You had people running up to, you know, Hillary Clinton, throwing business cards in her hand, and people trying to get themselves booked on Meet the Press at the funeral of the beloved host of Meet the Press, and people jockeying for the good eulogy slots and so forth. And I literally actually saw people scalping tickets to the funeral outside the Kennedy Center, which I'd never seen before, which was a real eye-opener. But again, I at that moment I knew that Washington had reached a tipping point of, I think, shamelessness. And I wanted to, again, give readers a sense of the full pageant that had grown up here and really the circus, which I thought was on perfect display at the Kennedy Center. I mean, you had all the mafia families convening. You had the Obamas and the Clintons and the McCains and the Bushes and the Democrats and the Republicans and the media and the lobbyists and, you know, all the usual suspects were there. And I just thought it was a scene. I sort of decided to start the chronology there.
And you refer to the site Politico as almost like an ESPN for political junkies. And then, you know, there's also this idea that, is it like People magazine in some sense too, where we hear about what's going on with these people? Is that, I'm going to sound like a real stick in the mud here, but is that dangerous when we talk about, okay, athletes, fine, actors, fine. But these are people we're electing to actually spend the money and decide where stuff goes and whether we go to war.
Right. No, yeah. I mean, you don't sound like a stick in the mud at all. I mean, I think that is an extremely appropriate reaction to this. I mean, and it's not just me who says that the Politico tries to be the ESPN for politics. I mean, that's basically their own mission statement. Hollywood is often compared to Washington. I mean, Washington has been called showbiz for ugly people, right? Or politics has been called showbiz for ugly people. The difference is, I mean, Washington is for keeps, as you said. I mean, this is a city that was supposedly built on public service. Now it has been so merged with celebrity. It has been so merged with the race to brand oneself and to cash in, whether in the next TV gig or the next lobbying gig or whatever, that you lose sight of the original mission that the city was built on. Again, I mean, I think the three things that have really, really informed the modern Washington that I write about are, again, the wealth, but also the celebrity, and also just what new media has done, which is, you know, really put the celebrity and the egotism of Washington that's always been there on some kind of steroids and really created this anarchy in the peanut gallery that is what we see every day there.
Mark, last question for you. John McCain is in this town, but also not too long ago you wrote an extensive piece on him for the New York Times magazine. Where's McCain on the list of Washington power brokers, and where is he on the list of, well, folks who always know there's a camera? I mean, I was the Sunday shows for a while. He was on one of those shows almost every week.
Yeah, he still pretty much is. I mean, John McCain is he's a pretty authentic figure. I spent a great deal of time actually out there with him in Phoenix and Tucson, and he's always different. He's always very, very complicated. He's obviously had an incredibly fascinating life and many, many different acts. But John McCain remains a fixture. I mean, I think he seems to be entering a new iteration where he is once again maybe going back into a maverick phase where, being a maverick is actually being more of a moderate Republican in the current Republican Party. And he's probably been on as many Sunday shows as any politician over the last 5-6 years. I think he holds the record for Meet the Press. In fact, right after Tim Russert died, I think he surpassed Bob Dole as the most recurring guest on Meet the Press.
Mark Leibovich, author of This Town, he's speaking tonight at ASU's Cronkite School. So we know Washington, D.C. is the biggest stage for political intrigue, along with backstabbing and backslapping, but Arizona gets a lot of national attention for some of the interesting things happening at our state capital. How much do we have in common with D.C.? With me to talk about that are former state lawmaker Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting and Chip Scutari of Scutari & Sizlak. Chip used to cover politics and government for the Arizona Republic. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
All right, Stan, let's start off with Arizona's political scene. Leibovich, in his book, writes about some of the show horses, the folks that really like to get on camera. They always know where the microphone is. Does Arizona have that kind of thing?
The short answer is yes, we do have that kind of thing. But to say it's the same kind of thing would be to give the wrong impression. In my opinion, the real dominating variable that separates us from D.C., is that we have far more what I call lovingly true believers that are in office or that run for office and serve than they do in D.C. I think I'm a jaded, scarred up guy. I think everybody in D.C. is one bubble off of the guy in House of Cards, just soulless and ruthless, and they don't kill people, but they would sell their mother out in order to be in office and to be reelected in the state house and state senate, and even at the governor and executive branch level of Arizona. You don't have that as the dominant. You've got some of those, but not many.
Right, but the true believer for some is a scarier term, because then you really, there isn't a chance for compromise, which people talk about a lot with politics.
Yeah, well, we could debate that in a whole nother show. Give me a true believer versus a guy that you have no idea what he stands for, and I can work with that. I being a person who wants a product out of the legislature. Okay. That's not a bad thing.
Chip, what do you think?
The problem is that when Stan uses the term true believer, some people interpret that for an ideological purist who won't compromise for the benefit of his constituents locally or across the state. And unlike when Stan was a lawmaker, I think, what was it, back in the 1880s?
Yeah.
1980s.
Almost.
Almost every issue now is federalized, is nationalized, whether it's, Obamacare is called Obrugercare. We had Russell Pierce, when he was Senate president, call it the Tea Party Caucus. So we've had this movement where these conservatives, I'm a Republican, but these uber conservatives who want to fight for states' rights are now just shifting more and more power to the federal government by their rhetoric.
So the dramatic intrigue, what goes on around there at the Capitol, does it become more or less interesting in an election year?
Yeah, it becomes more, but it there's always a baseline that's pretty good. For those of us who are Capitol watchers or involved in it, it would make its own great reality show. In fact, someone ought to do it, honest to good, but you can't get politicians to act naturally in a reality show, I would doubt. But there's always a vibration of a storyline and a drama, and then subsets of that drama, personality conflicts, people at war with each other, that sort of thing.
But unfortunately, at the state capitol, compared to maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago when Stan was down there, Stan and his group of Republicans back then actually came up with original ideas. I think they're most largely problem-solver Republicans, I'd call them. Nowadays, it's almost, you saw it with the Bundy Ranch incident. Let's go up there. It's a federal issue. Let's protest. protest there. We're not sure why we're protesting, and the guy's an out-and-out racist, but let's go up there and protest where we have so many problems in Arizona, whether it's K-12 education, university, CPS, but no one's really talking about the issues. There's very few lawmakers who roll up their sleeves, really want to solve problems. It's more about rhetoric that comes from groups like ALEC and George Soros on the left that funnel down through the states and through precinct committeemen that have, I think, hurt our politics and our public discourse and our public policy making over the last decade or so.
That does worry people a lot, Stan, in the sense that it's when we go out, let's say you're in the middle of nowhere driving from Phoenix to San Diego, you're going to see the same fast food restaurants, which in some cases is soothing because, oh, okay, I guess they're going to get the same product from somewhere. But at the same time, wow, where's the unique quality of that? Does Chip have a point in the sense that Arizona is losing some of its uniqueness by having certain issues that, okay, four other states are already doing that. Why are we taking it up now?
Yeah, I think Chip's the valid part of Chip's point is that, and it's not all valid, thanks, but the national money and a lot of localized politics has become nationalized. And national money plays and national money influences left and right. And we're all subject to what we're taking in as media content, and then that ends up getting regurgitated out from the House floor or the Senate floor. That did not exist in the mid-80s when I got elected. I was actually elected in 88. I was in the tail end of Stan Turley's mm-hmm. era.
Stan Turley.
Right, yeah. Right. He just passed away. He was 93 years old. And all of us think of that as the golden era of the Arizona legislature when the right and the left actually wanted to compromise on some functioning position. That politics played itself out and started to ebb and now is gone. And the reward is for an elected official to take the extreme position, hold it as long as they can until they have to give.
I'll give an example from the reporting world. I left the Republic late 2006, which isn't too long ago. I had a little bit more hair then, but still pretty much follically challenged. But now when I watch and observe the Capitol reporters, and it's not their fault, they're the shorter staff, smaller staffs, they're tweeting constantly about process issues. Mm-hmm. Like Senator Smith moved the bill to cow. And I think they're forced to do that because it's instant gratification, whereas they don't have the time to dig into bigger stories about what's the story behind the story? Why is this lawmaker doing that? Which lobbyists or lobbying groups are pushing him to do that? And there's still excellent work by our Capitol Press Corps, but I sense they're under so much stress to get the tweets out, the Facebook posts out, and I think that takes away from observing the Capitol, what's really going on behind the scenes.
Stan, you're a big fan of the process. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that, too. The press has changed, and how we report on the Capitol has changed and has not helped the process. Back to your original point, there is a show horse quality about it. There is a social media quality that looks like a show horse quality about it, where issues get reduced to 140 characters and no one understands anything. That's bad. And so I consider it a phase. I think we're just in a phase. This is the nature of the reflection of voters. The legislature is really a pretty good reflection, I think, of voters, which I know is a pretty big argument point, and not a lot of people believe that. But the Republicans that run the place, do get reelected. It's not all about gerrymandering. They do touch the right tone. And that's kind of where we are for the moment.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting and Chip Scutari of Scutari & Sizlak. Chip?
Stan is a brilliant, witty guy, as we all know, but I really have to disagree with him about that the legislature reflects Arizona, especially the mainstream Republicans.
Well, he said the voters.
You think it reflect the voters?
Yeah, I do. Chip's making a distinction, I think, is important as well. But.
I still disagree because I think a lot of these in legislative districts, such a small percentage of people vote, and it's their fault. Apathy is there on them, but they don't reflect the mainstream Arizona. And the reason I point to is statewide initiatives, whether it's Prop 100 to increase education taxes, passed overwhelmingly, clean elections funding, medical marijuana, those bills would never get through the state capitol. But they do on the ballot when it's a general audience.
Mm-hmm. Let's come back to an issue that parallels this town a little bit. In Washington, there are no term limits. In Arizona, there are term limits. There are pros and cons to that. Stan, you mentioned Stan Turley. Of course, Burton Barr's name comes up. We hear all the names of the past who seem to compromise a little bit more. So Term limits, good or bad?
Yeah, I used to be a fan. Now I'm an opponent. And it's hard to admit that out loud, but it's just, hey, we all evolve and grow, right? I still think they'd be great for Congress because I think they need some sort of constitutional stop stick thrown down to make themselves change, and they'll never will. In Arizona, it's wholly unnecessary and artificially games the process in a negative way. If everybody understood the reality of term limits at the local level, we would remove them immediately.
I totally agree with Stan on the local state level. We don't need term limits. I think Carolyn Allen once was a big proponent of a former state senator, mm-hmm. now says she wishes she could do away with it. On the federal level, I'm kind of schizophrenic on this. On the federal level, I kind of like John Huntsman, I think, had a proposal, maybe 18 years. You serve 3 Senate, U.S. Senate terms and 9 terms in Congress, and then you're out the door. About mm-hmm. the state level, I think it's hurt public policymaking.
And how is that affected? I guess you're both technically lobbyists, I'll use that term, not using it as a pejorative. I'm not, even though some people consider it that way. But is there a situation with the term limits where those folks who are focused on a couple of issues, as many lobbyists are, that they have undue influence? In some cases, positive influence, some cases negative. But is that influence a little bit too strong, Stephanie?
Yeah, I won't admit that it's too strong. Okay. I really don't genuinely believe it's too strong. We have a lot of strong personalities that just blunt all the lobbying that could be. President Biggs is famous for withstanding waves of expensive, well-suited lobbyists explaining the value of them because he believes in something, which is the point I was making earlier. The true believer thing really is a pejorative at the Capitol. And the way I mean it for your listeners today is that our class of elected officials is a lot more of an authentic actor rather than somebody that simply lives to stay in that office. Most of them have a base belief system, and you can't get them off of that for a lunch at Durant's or for a campaign contribution. All the legal ways in which to influence are really hard when you've got legislators that are not there to remain in office and to be friendly with the big money, but are there because they believe in something. That's what I meant by that earlier, and I think that's a good distinction between us and the book and Washington.
Okay.
You know, I'm not a registered lobbyist, but I talk to a lot of political figures. And I agree with Stan. When I cover the Capitol for 7 sessions, you know, certain lobbyists have more sway than others, but it's not in D.C. where they're, you know, totally, you know, bypassing the process. And I think that's, you know, you hear the word lobbyist, you think of a back room with cigars.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of constraints on state lobbying. And when something happens, it usually gets exposed.
Stan, I've got to come back to the true believer, and I think you explained that well, but I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be angry about this concept that there are people who don't like moderation or they don't like compromise, even on some issues that people tend to think of as private issues. So why is it that the legislature has to spend time doing these things? So as a former lawmaker, is there a feeling that lawmakers need to show they can flex their muscles even if Governor Brewer is going to veto something? Because it does seem like there are certain issues that we kind of know the governor is going to veto them. So why even go forward?
Yeah, you're thinking of 1062 this year and all the drama around that. That's probably the most difficult thing to explain. It really is difficult. Mm-hmm. That's one part people doing what they think is right. It's another part folks going along with the flow because they think that's where the politics is and they're not really sure. And it's another part people just kind of lost on the big view of it and the impact of it. And so it's every now and then we get these, and I don't condemn the process or the legislators themselves, because every now and then we put up something that the other branch of government can easily see is mm-hmm. ridiculous. That's why we have more than one branch of government. I consider that just the nature of things.
You know, if there's anyone who has a ton of power, and to her credit, it's Kathy Herod, who runs the Center for Arizona Policy, mm-hmm. on a bill like 1062. She works bills hard. She wants the lawmakers to pay attention to what she's doing. If not, you know, you have to answer their questionnaire the right way, or there may be a primary opponent. That's something where it reared its head with 1062. And I think a lot of people know that because it's such a small turnout in these legislative races, that they only have to be holding to a slice of the Republican electorate. And hopefully that will change. And they say independents don't vote. Maybe that will change with the millennial generation. I don't know. But right now, I think the right wing of the Republican Party, I think the social conservatives, have a little too much influence over the mainstream Republicans.
Guys, about 30 seconds left. Chip, I'll start with you on this. Most entertaining thing people should know about the state capitol. We talk a lot about some of the negatives and the behind-the-scenes dealings and the bills we hate.
You know, just the all the crazy stories that happen on a day-to-day basis, whether it's a guy feeding pigeons out by the, you know, the park bench, there's all these colorful characters. I used to love talking to the security guards just to see how their lives were, talk to the people who are at the front desk who don't really care about the politics of it but have an interesting story to tell. Those are my favorite parts of meeting the real people down at the Capitol.
Yeah, my answer to that is the 90 people that serve are really like 90 people straight out of the phone book. And if anyone listening to this broadcast were to pull 90 people out of the phone book and have them write the laws, it's about what we've got. And so everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, and they're either smart or not so smart, or honest or not so honest. There's just all that variety that makes it very interesting. It's one reason I love doing it. It's one reason people can do this for a while, because you get a new deck of cards to play with every election, and there's just all this personality. And the personality drives a lot more of this than you might think.
Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting, Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sislak. Guys, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the natural grocery battles in Arizona. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, announcing Encore Prizes for exceptional organizations that engage adults 50-plus in meeting community needs. Applications at pipertrust.org/encore.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. It'll be partly sunny in Phoenix today with a high of 79 degrees, mostly sunny and a little warmer tomorrow, high of 85, reaching 91 on Friday. Coming up at 12 o'clock, we'll have NPR's Here and Now from Boston. If you want to know what the U.S. is going to be like in 30 years, look to the generation that's under 33 right now, the millennials. There are plenty of stereotypes out there, but we'll see how they match up in their thinking against the boomers. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix. It's 68 degrees at 11:47.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. Yesterday, Whole Foods investors got some disappointing news when the grocery chain reduced its profit outlook. Is the company no longer an industry leader? Where is its competition coming from? For some insight, I turn to Joe Dobrow, formerly of the executive teams for both Whole Foods and Sprouts. His recently published book, Natural Profits, covers the natural food and grocery revolution, and he'll be talking about the book 1 week from tomorrow at Barnes & Noble in Scottsdale. Joe, good morning.
Morning, Steve. Good to be back with you.
So where is Whole Foods competition coming from now?
It's coming from everywhere. I mean, you could go into a Valero convenience store at the gas station and find natural and organic products. But a lot of it is coming from the conventional supermarkets. And Fry's, you know, the Kroger company, has done a fantastic job of adding natural and organic, getting great pricing out there. And that's really putting a lot of squeeze on the traditional natural grocers like Sprouts and Whole Foods.
Is John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, nervous about what's going on, regardless of what he said publicly yesterday?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it is. Well, you've been talking about matters at the Capitol here. It's been bloody Wednesday for the natural foods market on Wall Street. Whole Foods shares are down about 19% today. Sprouts shares are down 15 or 16% as of earlier this hour, and they don't even announce their quarterly earnings until 2 o'clock today. So I think you probably have people in both of the executive suites in those companies who are sweating bullets today.
So, Joe, what do they need to do then to get ready and realize that the competition has maybe caught up?
Well, let's look at it from two different perspectives. I mean, what is happening on Wall Street is actually very good news, or it reflects very good news for consumers. Mm-hmm. Because the fundamentals in the natural foods industry are really sound. You've got a $100 billion industry here that by every forecast I've seen looks like it's going to grow to $200 billion by the end of this decade. It's a reliable cash flow business. I mean, Whole Foods pays a dividend. More and more people are gravitating toward eating this way. So that's all good. The fundamentals are in place there. What Wall Street is punishing these guys for right now is the fact that there's so much more competition. Walmart has now re-entered the fray with their Wild Oats line, which was announced last month, with prices that are 25 or 30% below what you might find at Whole Foods. And so I think that what the Whole Foods and the Sprouts of the world need to do is to be patient because they need to get back to managing the business for the consumers and not managing the business on the, you know, quarter by quarter basis that most public companies do for Wall Street.
Boy, Joe, when you mention Walmart, that makes me think that Whole Foods, you know, might be facing even stronger competition from the standpoint that a lot of people at least think Whole Foods is a lot more expensive than average. Is it legitimately more expensive than average?
It is. It is. In fact, my consulting firm, Brickwall Strategy, we just completed a pricing study, and we looked here in Phoenix at 40 of the most common natural and organic branded items, and we looked in Fry's and at Sprouts and at Whole Foods. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit at the Barnes & Noble event on the 15th, but the headline on it is that Sprouts prices are about 5% below Whole Foods on average, but Fry's prices are about 12% below Sprouts. So there's no doubt that with more entrants and certainly with the power that Walmart brings to the table, even though there's not a lot of overlap in the customer base, but what it's going to do is it's going to force more pressure on all of these retailers out there to tighten up their profit margins a little bit. And that's going to mean lower prices for consumers. I have absolutely no doubt about that.
Joe, briefly, we've only got about 30 seconds left. How do you think Whole Foods could be affected by this recent announcement that Safeway and Albertsons are kind of sort of merging?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Both of those companies already have their natural and organic product lines out there, and the more buying power that they've got, the more they're going to end up driving profit margins down for everybody. So it may be that everybody, including Whole Foods, just sort of needs to readjust to this world in which they can't quite charge the high prices that they have been before, but I think that their businesses are in very good shape right now.
Joe Dobrow, author of the book Natural Profits. 1 week from tomorrow, he'll be at Barnes & Noble in Scottsdale, the one on Shea Boulevard, with the presentation Whole Foods, Sprouts, Fry's, and the Natural Foods Revolution. Joe, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Different kinds of speech and propaganda have helped lead to horrible events in world history, including assassinations and genocide. Tonight at 7 at the Burton Barr Library in Phoenix, Michael Abramowitz of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum will be presenting Do Words Kill? Michael, what's the difference between hate speech and dangerous speech?
The world right now is really awash in hate speech. And if you look at the kind of rhetoric that is coming from not just ordinary people, journalists, political leaders, you know, in countries as diverse as Burma, the Ukraine, Iran, certain countries in Africa, you see a proliferation of hate speech. You also see hate speech in the United States. If you look at, you know, at our internet, some of the derogatory things that are said by, you know, against gay people or African Americans. In some ways, I guess, you know, one could look at what Donald Sterling was quoted as saying the other day as a version of hate speech. But I think the issue that concerns our museum in particular is what we might call dangerous speech, which is really when hate speech crosses a line and has the potential to catalyze really violence. I think that's the kind of speech that we're most concerned on at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I think you have to look at a lot of issues. You have to look at context in particular. You know, is the audience, is the people that are being the recipient of this kind of hate speech, are they in a position to do something about it? If you or I were to go out into the middle of the street tomorrow and call on everyone to kill, you know, Native Americans, we would be thought of as crazy. It would be hateful speech, but we don't really expect anyone to act on that. But there's certain countries, you know, Burma today, where influential people have, you know, called on citizens to take action against Muslims. You know, and in fact, there have been massacres against Muslims in parts of Burma in recent years. So that people have had the capacity to act on it. That's the kind of speech that we really want to be concerned about.
The work that the museum is trying to do all across the world, how much more challenging does it become in this age of high tech and social media?
Well, it's a huge issue. So just by way of background, our museum is obviously what we call a living memorial to the victims of the Holocaust. But one of the most important ways that we try to honor the victims of the Holocaust is to do what we can to try to prevent these crimes from happening in the future against other people. So what we try to do at the museum is to raise awareness of those cases where we believe genocide is either threatened or actually genocide is actually happening. One of the things about genocide is that it is about the intentional destruction of racial religious groups. And so intent is key, and sometimes you don't know about genocide until it's actually happened. So our point is that we want people to act, our message is we want people to act preventively, to act when there are warning signs of genocide or warning signs of mass killing. And sadly, one of the key warning signs in history is when there has been really hateful speech that's been directed against groups. So you look at the Holocaust, for instance, and in the run-up to the Final Solution, Hitler and Goebbels and the other members of the Nazi apparatus spent a huge amount of time trying to condition the German people through propaganda to really think of Jews as less than human.
How much of this rests on the fact that that we as human beings, why are people susceptible to propaganda or dangerous speech? Why is there not more shouting down of these people and saying these ideas are absurd and you're killing my neighbor, you're killing my friend or my family?
You know, that's a great question. I wish I had a definitive answer to it. But the reality is that hatred of the other is something that has sadly been something that has been with us for a long time, you know, long preceded the Holocaust. And I suppose one thing it's a way for political leaders to gain power, to, you know, to really play on people's fears about others. So the point that I would make is that we're all susceptible to this. I think what's really important is education. That's really one of the central missions of our museum, to educate people. And I think, you know, one of the issues is, what do you do about hate speech? Some people say that we ought to, you know, censor hate speech. You know, in America, we have the First Amendment, which really makes it constitutional prohibition on in favor of free speech. But I do think there are other ways, and if you can step up and denounce hate speech, so-called counter speech, there are different tools that you can use to really educate the people against hate speech.
Can you change people who are adults? In this case, can you teach an old dog new tricks as far as not hating others?
You know, it's never too early to try, and it's never too late to try. You know, one thing that I found interesting, it didn't get a lot of attention in the United States, but in 2007 in Kenya, there were elections, and the elections were essentially polarized along ethnic and tribal lines, and you had political leaders in Kenya kind of taking advantage of these fault lines to try to foment divisions and catalyze support for their own positions electorally. After the elections in Kenya, there were hundreds of people who died in ethnic violence. I think maybe more than 1,000. Kenya had another election in 2012, and there was recognition that the 2007 elections had not gone well. And so there was a great deal of focus, first of all, in Kenyan society, on making sure that the elections were held peacefully, to make sure that people were aware that they should be on guard against hate speech and not to be susceptible to it. The international community, the United States, but also neighboring African countries, really tried to focus attention. The newspapers carried a lot of information calling on people to be tolerant and peaceful and to respect differences. And lo and behold, it was a relatively peaceful election. Not perfect. There were problems there. But it did say to me that there is hope by putting attention on this, that you can inoculate, so to speak, your audiences against hate speech.
Michael Abramowitz of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. He'll be in Phoenix tonight at 7 at the Burton Barr Library. The presentation is called Do Words Kill? That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear this program again or hear previous segments, go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app. Now we head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great afternoon. It's 12 noon.